This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 317, recorded live from SharePoint Fest Seattle, where we're going to talk about DevOps and the latest news in the cloud. Recorded live, August the 22nd, 2019.
If you could score an extra hour or two back in your day, would you take it? Because our friends over at Nintex want to give you a gift. The gift of time. Seriously, if you haven't checked out what Nintex has to offer lately, you should. The platform built on Azure has evolved a lot. In just the past few months, the Nintex team has added new process mapping capabilities, and most recently, a new e-sign capability called Nintex Sign, powered by Adobe Sign. Nintex also continues to revolutionize products you know and trust, including Nintex Workflow and Forms. With the power of Nintex, it is faster and easier for you to configure, not code, giving you valuable time back every day to spend it however you want. Test drive the Nintex Process Cloud at Nintex.com.
Hey CJ, how's it going?
Pretty good, buddy. How are you? Good to see you in person.
It's good to see you in person. This is a little, and we've done this before, but this feels more awkward right now for some reason.
Super. We're sitting on a stage in Seattle.
Yep.
And normally we're over Skype.
Yep.
That's
a couple years ago.
Over Zoom. Over Zoom, I should say. So it's feeling a little different for us this week.
It is feeling a little bit different. We are, this is, I guess, for a little bit of a description to our people who are actually here in person, and then people are going to hear this, the recording, when it comes out on, right now it'll be next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, yep.
So for those of you who are at the conference, we're over in the corner of the expo hall at the podcast booth where we're doing a live recording of our show. And we're also recording it like we normally do our shows, so you can kind of see a little bit of behind the scenes. So it's kind of, for the people who are live here, there would be some weirdish kind of stuff that goes on.
Yep.
Because we have a couple of spots that we break to get some our sponsors in there.
We make some funny hand signals.
Yeah, you'll see us kind of look up like, you know, assume the position. Nope, no police here. But for those of you who are listening to the recording, if it sounds a little awkward, well, it's because CJ's on the call.
Yeah.
But no, it's because we're doing this live, so maybe a little bit of an echo in the background. But there we go. Got that stuff out of the way.
Yep. You'll see a little bit behind the sausage machine.
A little bit what's going on, yeah. So yep. How you doing, man?
Very well. Yeah, very well. I've been traveling and it's nice to be at home and have the show come to your hometown.
Yeah.
As opposed to have to go to a conference, which is really quite a nice change. But it's been really good. I've been super busy at work, obviously, but it's nice to get away and come to downtown Seattle and hang out at SP Fest. I did a session yesterday on sort of my top five tips and tricks for Microsoft Graph, which went well, and I did a bunch of. It's basically a 70-minute session of demos of using the graph and some interesting things like batching, Delta query, webhooks, change notifications, multi-resource refresh tokens.
MRRTs.
MRRT, is that actually the acronym?
MRR is. I thought it was RMM, but that doesn't make sense. So yeah, MRR makes more sense.
Gotcha. Yeah, so use those, whatever those are.
Exactly, yeah.
So covered a bunch of demos, five or so different demos, and hopefully people walk away with, you know, having learned a few lessons from things I whacked my head into along the way of building Hyperfish.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. How about you? What have you been up to here?
Well, before we go there, I walked by your room yesterday. I was in the speaker room getting some work done, ducked out to use the restroom, and I'm walking by as you're doing a recap. But I didn't know it was your room. I just kind of glanced into rooms as you walk by, and I see on the slide, there's a big picture of me on the slide. It was you and me.
Yeah.
There's a big picture of me, and I did like a double take.
Your photo.
What the hell is somebody showing my picture up on the slide? And it was the slide where you talked about the podcast. And I was like, oh, it's CJ.
Yeah, I threw that up there just so that, we may get some new listeners through things. We talk about the graph a bunch on the show,
yep.
So thought, why not?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. I did a full-day workshop on kind of like the introduction to the SharePoint framework on Monday. I did a half-day workshop on React in the SharePoint framework on Tuesday. I did a session on SharePoint framework and DevOps yesterday. That's kind of what we're going to talk about the latter part of our episode today. I'm doing a session today. I think it's working with third-party APIs and the SharePoint framework, like Graph and...
You think it is?
Yeah, I think it is. Well, I have two more sessions. I forget which one's which, but I know they're all ready. So I just like,
okay, good.
Which one's right?
And are you sure you're ready for this?
I tested both of them last night, and then I was like, wait, which one's today? And then I've got one tomorrow on being a SharePoint framework ninja. So telemetry, performance, tips and tricks, stuff like that.
Nice.
So... packed schedule, but
you got plenty going on.
I do. Make the most of it.
Yeah, it's a long way to come. So.
Yeah. I like this show too. I mean, I like having just one session a day. where you are around the conference, you get opportunity to talk to people that are here and all that. I like this setup. So we have some fun news to share a little bit. We got word this week that we will be doing live video show, at least one live video show at Ignite. Maybe we have two, but that marks every single Ignite we will have done a live video stream from the podcast floor, from the conference floor.
I mean, this decides it for me now. I need to go.
Well, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not doing a solo show.
You got this, buddy. Rock on.
You can helicopter in. Nobody will notice. That's fine.
Fly in for the show, fly out. It'll be great.
Yeah. I got word that I'm also doing a pair of breakout sessions, like introduction to the SharePoint framework and introduction or React 101 for the SharePoint framework. So got a couple things there that'll be presenting. It's the first time I will have presented Ignite since the very first one. Well, I haven't submitted for the conferences. I didn't like presenting there for the first one. I didn't find there'd be much value for it. As you just kind of, you fall into a mass of people.
There's a lot of people.
And I didn't like all the hassle for it. And so now I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to submit a couple sessions I like doing that are pretty core, and hopefully I can get a big audience for it. And I like doing these topics for people who are brand new to it. So it's not, they're not new sessions I've done. They'll be new to people who are there, but they're not new sessions I've done. And so I'm already really comfortable with the ones I got picked. And I'm just curious to see how it's kind of run behind the scenes and stuff this time around. So,
yeah, I mean, it's gained a lot of momentum over the last few years, and I reckon it's been getting better and better each year.
I agree.
So hopefully they can keep that up. Often these things start waning and get a little old from time to time. So hopefully they spice it up and keep things fresh.
Yeah.
But yeah, having a live show there will be awesome again. At least one. Hopefully we get a couple. But we'll let everybody know when those are going to be, and we'll send out email to you and invites to come along to the show. And we'll have, we were just talking before the show about ordering a whole bunch more swag.
Yes, we need more shirts.
We need more shirts and some more giveaways and things. So we're definitely going to organize that for Ignite.
Absolutely.
So come see us there.
Absolutely. And the other thing too, we had one of our sponsors we've already heard from in the introduction to the show. Nintex has got a cool little event coming up in October, September and October, right?
Indeed. Nintex are running Process Fest, which is their conference that they're putting on. It's actually in Bellevue this year, so it's in their sort of home turf, so to speak. Actually, fun fact about Nintex, they are in the original building that Microsoft moved into when they moved to Redmond.
No kidding.
Yep.
Huh.
So Bill Gates' first business card was actually a building in Bellevue, not in Redmond.
Right.
And it's in the building that Nintex is now in. How about that?
A small world.
It is.
That's pretty cool.
Anyway, so they're doing Process Fest in Bellevue on September 30th through October 3rd. And it's all about workflow, as you can imagine, transforming the way people work. And 3-day conference, they've got a pre-day as well. You can go check their stuff out at nintex.com/Nintex Process Fest 2019.
Very cool.
They didn't ask us to plug this on the show. I just picked up one of their flyers from their booth and I thought, this looks really cool. I want to go to this. And so, if you're into business process automation and all that sort of stuff, might be for you.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's now another one of our sponsors has their own event that they've done. I know Nintex has done a couple of them in the past. And what was it? AvePoint just did their Shift Happens.
Yes, happened, Shift
what,
Happens.
Back in July, I think it was.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
So that, and I heard a lot of really good things about that from some people this week. So I guess
let's get on to the meat and potatoes.
We got a bunch of news we want to get through, and then we want to get into the actual like feature of the show. But before we do that, we got to hear from one of our great sponsors.
For those of us familiar with ShareGate, we know that they've always been about SharePoint and Office 365 migration. But now that we've all moved to the cloud, like me, you're probably thinking, how about how to scale your Office 365 to a full self-serve environment without worrying about thousands of groups and teams popping up out of nowhere, aka sprawl. That's why the folks at ShareGate developed ShareGate Apricot. It's a solution that helps us automate our Office 365 groups governance by allowing us to collaborate with users to keep everyone accountable for the things they create. Their super simple to use in-app experience lets us lighten our load by delegating group management responsibilities to users we trust, aka no more sprawl. Want to get your hands on ShareGate Apricot? Try it for free for 30 days at ShareGate.com/collegeshow.
All right, CJ. Some people looked at us like, what are they doing?
What's Beavis and Butthead doing over here? Yeah.
All right, CJ, we got some news here. Some Azure news, we got some Graphy news, Yeah. What you got for us? What do you want to share with us first?
So first up on the cards, we've got some Azure news. We'll go through a few of these things. First one is general availability of Azure Ultra Disk Storage.
Ultra?
Ultra.
Really big or really fast?
Ultra sounds more ultra than premium.
Yeah, no,
right?
No,
so you've got moderately slow, pretty reasonable, better, premium, and now ultra. So Ultra Disk Storage is new managed disk offering for sub-millisecond latency for high I/O workloads. So I can imagine this would be really important for people hosting database servers,
right?
Where you've got Postgres or SQL or Oracle or what have you, and you just need really low latency disk access and super high throughput, lots of IOPS, right? Or give me all of the IOPS. I don't know what this will cost, but I suspect it's not cheap.
Yeah.
Customers can now maximize disk performance by leveraging up to 300 IOPS per gigabit to a maximum of 160,000 IOPS per disk.
That's pretty high.
160,000 IOs per second, right? That's what IOPS are.
Can a VM handle that?
I don't know. Maybe a big one? I don't know. That's a lot of throughput, surely.
That's a lot of throughput. So
yeah.
I guess the next ones we'll see, we'll probably get an announcement at Ignite for, what did you say? We got normal, we got hot, we got premium, now we got ultra. I think then it goes, ludicrous and plaid?
That's right. Ludicrous mode. Exactly. So yeah, apparently you can put 2 gigabits per second per disk through this thing. Anyway, it's, I guess it's not for the faint of heart, but for those needing to eke out performance in high I/O workloads, then that is, this could be for you.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. There's another one here. Speaking of crazy new things in Azure, there's a new thing called Project Terragrade. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's a new virtual machine resiliency project. Now, this is a code name, I believe. So the blog post is by Mark Rusinovich, who's the CTO of Azure. And apparently this thing is named after some sort of microscopic bug with like 8 legs or something.
This is the one that can live in the volcano.
It draws its inspiration from the 8-legged microscopic creature. The Terragrade is also known as the water bear, virtually impossible to kill.
That's the one that the Israelis crash landed and dropped about 1,000 of them thousands of them on the moon. Remember we talked about that the last episode?
Oh, really? That's what these things were?
That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess what Mark Rusinovich is saying here is they're going to be able to give you virtual machines that will survive, nuclear winter or something.
You won't be able to kill these things. You won't be able to decommission them.
Yeah, I don't know all of the details about exactly how this works, but in effect, it's basically to try and give you the ability to stand up a VM that's just impossible to kill due to data center failure or network conditions or any sort of unexpected host issues that might come to bear.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Pretty wild, huh?
That is pretty crazy. And they've done some other stuff, too, around some actions for GitHub, too. Have you seen these?
Yeah, I haven't actually used them, but this is pretty nice. I imagine being able to, hook the stuff from GitHub into DevOps more easily.
These are cool. Like, there's some that we have that are out of the box in GitHub. I'd like to put this on the SharePoint, the SP DevDocs issues list, because there's one called the StaleBot. And it watches PRs and issues that don't have any activity for a long time, and it just automatically closes them. Leaves a message, says, thanks for your contribution, no activity, we're going to go and close this. If you still got an issue, open up a new one and reference this.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The one I'm excited about here is the K8's actions.
Ah.
Connect and deploy to Kubernetes cluster, including Kubernetes clusters.
AKS. There you go.
There you go.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. In fact, we had a really hard time building this in DevOps to connect to our AKS cluster and push new versions of our Helm charts and all that sort of stuff. So it's nice to see that they've got some out-of-the-box actions that you can go use.
That's very cool.
Pretty sweet.
That's very cool.
Hey, you know how a while ago Microsoft said they were coming out with a customized version of the Linux OS?
Yes, yeah, the Sphere.
For Azure Sphere?
Yeah.
They put up a new blog post about this with Azure Sphere OS begins with a long-term support, or LTS, Linux kernel. I just thought this was just, I don't know much about this stuff, but I just find it fascinating that Microsoft's going down this path, releasing a version of Linux that they're going to continually support and are putting out now long-term support versions, which you can sort of rely on for multiple years, is my understanding.
Yeah.
But the whole purpose of this is to power IoT scenarios with Azure Sphere. So it'll be We saw the news, was it Ignite last year? We started talking about Sphere, something like that.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it was, with Julia White.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was about that time the news came out. So yeah, now they're talking about their LTS first version of that, I believe, is coming out, which is pretty nice.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. And more goodies.
We see another thing, too, that Microsoft has done with Azure Functions for the science-y, research-y people in mind.
Yeah, GA of Python support. Mm. So if you're a Python lover, now you get like Node and .NET or C#, I suppose. Python, there's a bunch of language choices in Azure Functions.
Yep.
Pretty nice. Yeah. I know that lots of students and things are using Python and stuff, so I imagine Python support in functions and places like that are really important to Microsoft.
It's one of those languages. There's two languages that I want to learn. I want to get under my belt. And one of them is Python and one of them is Go. And it just to get a little bit more experience with, the more I spend with Go, the more I like it.
Yep. Go is, I think, is going to be my thing. Like, I really like the idea of Go.
Yeah.
It feels quite C-sharp-y in some ways.
Yep.
But it's also sort of semi-compiled. It's
very modern, very cloudy, cloud-friendly, very like message-friendly. And I mean, all the container stuff is all based off Go, is all written in Go too.
Exactly.
So it's nice. You see a lot of the templating languages. We talked about this before the show, where there's a Go templating language that they use in Helm. We're using it in Hugo. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it'd be super useful. And, you know, I can read parts of it and kind of follow along.
Yeah.
But I couldn't sit at a blank canvas and write Go.
Yeah. It has a very C feel to it. And so there's a learning curve. There's a bit of a learning curve.
Right. So that's the Azure news. Microsoft Graph have made some interesting announcements recently on August the 20th. This is really cool.
Yeah, right? This is neat.
So as a developer, one of the things that you really struggle with when you get a developer tenant or you start with Office 365 and wanting to use the graph is you kind of struggle with having good data in your tenant to start working with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Microsoft are putting out a new graph sample data pack. And the cool thing about this is it's baked into Office 365. So you literally go into the portal and click a button in your Office 365 developer dashboard.
Mm-hmm.
You go click this button that says plus users, and it'll go and install the user's sample data pack into your tenancy, which is...
It's really cool.
Really, really helpful.
That is something that has been needed for 10 years?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not just in the graph.
And the rest, right? Everything was... I remember back when we were putting out SharePoint virtual machines.
Yeah, AdventureWorks.
AdventureWorks, the sample VMs. And we had these packs of data and demos that you could install. And it was a mission, right? It was really hard. And it was all automated with PowerShell and custom code and everything, jam all the stuff in. And it was inevitably a real pain in the butt to do. So it's really nice to see Microsoft putting out these sample packs with user data. And they've also got ones for mail and events, i.e. meetings and invites and stuff like that. So with users, you get obviously user details. You get a direct reporting, like an org structure baked in, and users get departments and stuff like that too. And then you get emails and some upcoming events and things.
Well, what's nice about this is that now, before a lot of developers were having to use the data in their own production tenants to be able to do a lot of work, to be able to test it and kick the tires. And you never really like to work with your dev, with your live data, and you're always kind of scared, am I going to mess stuff up? Or your live data's got some test data in it. It's nice to be able to go spin up a brand new tenant or like your dev tenant that you can get from the Office 365 developer program and then load it with some data so that you can actually have a play with it for a bit. So
yeah, if you're a partner, you usually get access to demos.microsoft.com.
Yes.
Which is a way you can go get sort of demo tenancies for a short, a 30 or 60 day period of time or something.
Yeah.
90 day period of time. And you have the ability to load demo packs into those. And that's how I do this. But it's nice for dev tenancies to get the stuff now.
Yeah, it really is.
So that's available through the Office 365 developer program dashboard.
Yeah, very sweet.
Dun, dun, dun.
The other one that they have, too, we got another little bit of graph news. This is really cool what they've done, the graph toolkit.
Yeah. I spoke about it a little bit yesterday, and I know Jeremy Fake from the graph team also spoke about this, but they've been putting quite a lot of effort into putting out a library of web components for doing common things in your applications that hook to the graph.
Mm.
So the latest one that they're talking about is People Picker, right? Every app has a People Picker in it, either to assign permissions to people or to search for people or do something like that. So now there's a component you can drop on a page, you can get it all hooked up to, it's all hooked up to the graph. It's framework agnostic through web component technology. And it's really simple to get a people picker in your application.
Yeah, that's cool.
But it's pretty sweet. It's all up on GitHub, so you can go check out the samples and go play around. And you can see some, we'll link to this off in the show notes too.
That's very cool.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, so that's a bunch of the news we wanted to cover. One of the things we haven't done in a while is we haven't sat down and done like a feature explore of an Azure or Office 365 feature.
Yep.
And that's something we wanted to do in this episode. But before we do that, let's hear from a pair of our great sponsors. Struggling to reproduce problems in your code base? Successful software starts with Raygun. Raygun provides application performance monitoring unlike anything that you've experienced before, offering greater clarity around how your software is performing for your customers than any other APM provider. Easily detect and diagnose issues impacting end users and monitor every part of your stack in one place. It's time to get back to building great software instead of fighting it. Start your journey to better software quality and try Raygun for free at raygun.com today. A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
So CJ, one of the things, we talked a little bit about this in our last episode, episode 316, but a little bit behind the scenes, we were running out of time. We both had a hard stop when we were doing our last recording and we started to see we were getting a little long in the tooth. And so we kind of raced through the very end of how do you deploy it, right? And so I did put a blog post out about this that explained how we do it with Hugo, both on the podcast and how I do it on my side as well. Oh yeah, and by the way, for all of our listeners, we're sorry. We tried. We spent a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to make sure that the RSS feed would be absolutely identical from the way it was before. And specifically, in the RSS feed, there's a field, a permalink, which says where's the episode live.
Yeah.
And we checked everything to see, make sure it's not going to change, make sure it doesn't change. So that way, when we publish a new episode, it won't force you guys to download everything in the feed again.
Turns out we failed miserably.
Well, in our defense, I understand why now. I think I know what happened, but it's kind of stupid that that FeedBurner saw these as new links.
Yeah, yeah.
So in our old show, it put a :80 in the domain. So it was www.microsoftcloudshow:80/something.
Yeah, like port 80.
Yeah. And our new one doesn't have port 80 on it. Apparently that made it seem different. So in one sense, we're really sorry. On the other sense, don't tell our sponsors that we got a nice little spike in our stats for the month of August.
We'll chop those out.
But, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, in a nutshell, right? In a nutshell, we launched the new site. We got the RSS and everything switched over. We got all the episode posts are up, all of that sort of stuff. It all worked flawlessly. Mm-hmm. In fact, the site is running really, really well.
Yep.
Except the RSS feed changed slightly and you may have got some new episodes that aren't so new and you... podcast.
You get to re-listen to every episode since 253.
Well, it depends on your podcast app, right?
Oh, that's true, yes.
Like for mine, I only have it set to download the latest 3 episodes.
Right, yep.
And so all of the others didn't download for me. Yep. So when I saw this happen, I was like, I think we might have struck a problem, but yeah.
Oh, we did. I woke up and I was like, why is my phone so slow?
Downloading the internet. Nice.
Yeah, I wish it was on the hotel Wi-Fi, but...
Like you said, one of the things we definitely skipped over and with speed last episode was we talked about our move to Hugo. Mm-hmm. We talked about all of the differences between static sites versus dynamically generated content management systems for delivering our site. And we also touched on using Azure DevOps to go build our site and deploy new episodes and things.
Yep.
And so this episode, I thought we could build on some of the things you're talking about in your sessions at the show about Azure DevOps, how we're applying that to our podcast, and also more importantly, I think, for many of our listeners at least, how this applies to the SharePoint framework and SharePoint framework projects.
Yeah. What I wanted to do first, I wanted to explain the difference. Like, what are we talking about? So if this was new to me. And so if it was new to me, it's got to be new to some other people as well.
Absolutely.
Let me go through and demystify this. So when we first set this up. Well, first of all, what is Azure DevOps? It's effectively, think about it as like GitHub plus like a continuous integration environment all in one. So on, it has the ability for you to store your projects. You can have like wikis on it. You can have a dashboard. But then you also have a whole section called, and then a place for like work items and tracking, like task tracking and stuff like that, and bugs and et cetera. You also have a section called pipelines. And what the pipelines are, that's really the continuous integration, continuous deployment stuff. So when we first did this, we set it up using what's called classic mode. I didn't know that that was classic, but it was classic mode. And what classic mode is that's the current production DevOps environment. So the other one we're going to look at in a minute or talk about in a minute is YAML pipelines. And that's currently a preview feature. You have to manually turn it on to be able to leverage it. We've done both. We've actually switched over to the preview YAML pipelines. It's running really well. And it's I like it a lot more. And so we'll talk about that more. But let me kind of explain what the difference is first. So classic mode, when you're in classic mode and you click on the navigation in Azure DevOps, under pipelines, you'll see in the menu on the left-hand side, it says build and release. And the idea here is these are two different, I want to call them phases. I don't want to call them stages. They're really
processes.
Stages.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't want to call them stages because the stage is a real thing.
Right.
But you'll understand why I'm struggling with it in just a minute. So in the build phase, you can have, it's one phase and you can have multiple jobs in that phase. So you can have like a build job, a test job, whatever else you're doing to make sure that things are actually working. Maybe multiple tests. Maybe you want to do a matrix of tests where you're testing on like different Linux and Windows and whatever. And then you also had a release, and the releases were where you did your deployment. And a release had a trigger that started it, like a successful build. And then you also had a multiple stages inside of it, okay? So when you wanted to create, one of the big things that's going to be different you'll see between the two is that when you wanted to create a build stage, you could do that either using a little GUI, little web browser GUI, that all that did was let you pick the different tasks.
Yep.
And it would, once you filled out the form, it would generate the YAML and put it into your Azure-Pipelines YAML file. So you could either write it in YAML from the start, or you could do it visually and it would build the file for you.
I think even originally you couldn't, it wouldn't even output to YAML.
It would.
No, it was only the GUI kind of web builder to put these things together.
Right. That's how it works today. And that, so that's how it works today. So you can do it like that, have it in your project. The hard part though was with the releases is you had to do that. You don't have to, but you generally did all of that through the GUI. And if you wanted to save it, you could export your releases, but it was as a giant JSON file. And then you'd have to manually import it back into YAML pipelines to get it to work. So it was
a little clunky.
It was a little clunky. It wasn't really all that ideal. So what Microsoft did is they introduced this new concept. They introduced it back, I think, in build of this year. And the idea here is it's called YAML pipelines. Now, what's different about this is that gone are these two separate things of build and release. So what you do is you have to turn this on. So the way you do is you go up and when you're logged into YAML into Azure DevOps, in the top right corner, you click on your name, drop down, there's a menu option where you have like my profile.
Experimental features or something.
Preview features.
Preview features.
Yeah, so you go preview features and you have to toggle on the multi-stage pipelines. So the way that this works now is that when you go, now your navigation doesn't have build and release, it just says pipelines. And there is an also release section, but you really just see pipelines. And so what this does is a couple things. You can now have multiple stages. Then you can define those stages however you want. So before, when I had a build stage, I would have a build job and I would have a build and a test job. Now I can have a stage that's build and a stage that's test, and multiple things are happening. The other thing that you can do too is you can define another kind of a stage that's called, another stage, and then inside that stage, you have a special kind of a job called a deployment.
I see.
So it's just got a different name. And what's cool about making it a deployment is that in the future, let's say you roll out version 2 and version 2 is all screwed up. And you went, I've got to fall back. You don't have to go do anything in the code. You just go into DevOps and say, go back to 1.9 and go to that release and say, do that deployment again. And it just takes the same artifacts deployed last time and rolls them back out.
Nice.
So you can roll back real easy. That's one big difference. So you can have these multiple stages. And stages can be interdependent of each other and all that stuff. The other big change is that with YAML pipelines, everything can be expressed in a YAML file. The build still has a nice little visual designer you can still use, but the release side doesn't. And so you still have to, you'd have to actually really define it inside YAML. This is cool though, because with 100% of your pipeline inside of a YAML file, It's in source control. You can actually rev your build and test and deployment process in a separate branch and test it all out. And then when you're good, merge it over to master, and then you just change all your deployment stuff.
Yeah, that's right. I love that. I love that all the configuration is code.
Yes, right? Me too.
That's really cool. One of the issues I've absolutely hit in the past is, you know, you're building a project, and in my case, it was a C# project, and then I wanted to change the way the build works, but only for that particular version, right? Because I was kind of upgrading libraries, and I was doing a bunch of things, and I wanted to change the way the build worked, and so I had to go into Azure DevOps and change the build there, but it was really only applicable to that particular branch or that version of the code, right? And so there was a point at which I had to basically make the big switch and switch the build process and merge everything into, in my case, it was the development branch, but it was a one-shot thing.
Yep.
You know, I couldn't have a particular build process just for that branch without doing a whole lot more work.
Yeah.
And so now being able to define it all in YAML, have it version controlled in my repo, just like all the rest of my code, really, really helps.
It really does. It really does. And so it's, when we originally did this, we set up the podcast using the classic mode. And then I played around with it on my site, on my blog when I launched that. And with the new YAML support, moved all my stuff over, convinced you and said, hey, would you let me go to town on the podcast one? I switched it over, and it's just, the fact that we were able to do it that fast was, and it's working great, just, it shows that things are really good. So we have two stages set up. We have a build stage and we have a deployment stage for the podcast. Each one has a job, but we run the jobs twice. One of them for a preview site that you guys can't see. CJ and I use that to see, make sure that the next episode comes out, isn't screwed up. And then we do it again, deployment, same thing. And so
For production,
yeah.
Yep.
Now what gets cool is, I did this yesterday in my session, is I spent a lot of time doing this as a SharePoint framework, and this is really cool to be able to completely automate everything with a single commit that you're going to make and see it all roll out.
Yeah, so I guess for podcasts, it's all about Hugo and files being copied to blob storage.
Yep.
The example project that I just talked about was a C# project, was basically building an executable.
Mm-hmm.
And then the deployment was actually pushing it out to deployment server and stuff like that. But what does that look like for SPFX projects? Like, what sort of build steps do you have? And then what do the test steps look like? And then also, what do the deploy steps look like?
Yeah, so, you know, with the SharePoint Framework project, you know, what you're doing is your artifact that you're building, and I use that word intentionally, that when you, the thing that you're creating is a SharePoint package, SPPKG file.
The magical zip file.
That's the magical zip file. And what you need to do with that needs to go ultimately into an app catalog, which is either at the entire tenant level or it's at a site collection.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to deploy it. And that's the part of like effectively installing it. So you upload the file and then you install it into the site. Mm-hmm. So what you can do is the way I showed this in my session is I have three stages. One of them, there's three copies of it, but I have three stages. I have a stage that does the build, and his job is to do like gulp build, gulp bundle, gulp package solution.
Build the code.
You build the code. Yeah, build the code and generate that package. And that SharePoint package, I take that and I publish that as an artifact. So what happens with pipelines is that when you publish an artifact, you're doing that for two things. Number one, you're effectively saying this file should be attached with this pipeline run for me to go grab it later. But also it makes it available to other stages in the pipeline. So at the same time we're doing the build, I also run tests. So all my tests are set up, but I want to run those tests. So I have my pipeline set up so that the build stage and the test stage, those two can run without any predefined precursors, dependencies, whatever. They can run simultaneously in parallel. And if both of those things pass, then I want to go through and do my deployments.
So your tests at this point, they're not like that you've deployed the thing correctly or that the thing is running properly. It's running all your unit tests.
Correct.
And that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's running my unit tests. And actually, before we go on, there's something cool about that too. What you can do with the DevOps pipelines, and you can do this too in the regular, like classic DevOps. What you can do is that when you run all of your tests, you can configure your tests so it outputs a code coverage file. I think it's called COVID era.
Yeah, I know what you've
that
seen
format.
Those. Yep.
And then you can also export the JUnit file, the JUnit reporter, which essentially says how long did tests take, did they pass, succeed, you know, fail, whatever. And when you have those two files, when your tests are complete, after everything's passed, you can publish those two assets as well. And DevOps will have a little tab where you have a summary on your pipeline run. At the top, it says summary, see everything.
You can also have a test tab. You go there and it shows you the results of all your tests. And then you have a code coverage tab as well. And it uses the code coverage output to generate a whole code coverage report that it saves as an artifact that you can go look at later.
Nice.
That's really slick.
So for every build, you can see exactly how your tests ran, which ones succeeded, which ones failed, and then obviously how much code you're getting with your tests through code coverage and making sure you got good, good coverage.
And they've got stuff already baked into it too, where in DevOps, where it does even analytics and it looks at, you know, your tests are getting faster or they're getting slower or this test is getting slower or your code coverage is going up or code coverage on this file is going down or just does a really good job of the insights of what's going on. Now, the next step is you want to do your deployment.
Yeah.
And the way I set this up is that I have a single deployment job template that I created, right? And what this template does is it takes a bunch of inputs in, and one of the inputs that it takes in is the URL of where you want this deployed.
Like the SharePoint URL.
The site collection.
The tenant name, you know, like contoso.onmicrosoft.com. Oh, sorry, .sharepoint.com.
Yeah, so where do you want to deploy this? And so you can imagine that, like in my case, I created three separate environments. Now, for me, I was doing the poor man's demo, so it was just everything was in one tenant. One site collection was dev, one site collection was staging, one site collection was in prod.
Right.
Now, let me explain the dev one first, and then explain how this whole thing fans out. And this is where it gets really cool. So I said that all three of these guys can also run in parallel, but they depend on the build stage and the test stage to succeed. So they all just sit there until build and tests are done. If they succeed, then they can all start. And the way that they work is that they say, let's say for dev, he's going to take that package, he downloads the artifact from the pipeline that was created in the build phase, takes that SharePoint package and uploads it to the first thing step it does is it installs the Office 365 CLI. I got to have a way to be able to talk to SharePoint.
To be able to push the thing to Office 365.
Right. So I take that, I log in. So I have a variable group that's got name value pairs in there for username and password that I use to log in and deploy in my deployment. So he logs in, he logs into Office 365, he uploads the package, and then he calls using the CLI to go ahead and deploy it as well.
Hmm.
All of it automatic.
Nice.
Right? So once that's all done, let's say then you go to your site and you go drag that web part and you put it on your test page. So I've done that now inside all three of my different environments. And this is where it gets cool. You can set up in pipelines to say, I only want certain things to run under certain conditions. So like, for example, let's say I'm doing some work on a new feature branch. Right? So any branch that gets a push to it, you can have your pipeline configured to always do deployment to the dev environment, but don't do the other ones.
I see.
For the other ones, if you ever do a push to the staging branch, I've set that one up to go with the staging environment so that it'll always do the deployment to dev and the staging.
Gotcha.
Right?
Gotcha.
But then it gets really cool. Then it's like, well, production. Whenever there's a push to master, it's always going to do the deployment to dev. But I also have it say that's also going to go to production, but I don't want that to go live to production. On that stage, I've gone into the GUI and I've said, I'm going to add a check and that this user a user from this group must approve it.
Yeah, I see.
So the way that works is that now
it's like it's a gated push.
It's an eyes on.
Yeah.
That is the only part of Azure DevOps that you can't have inside your YAML pipeline.
And I see.
It's not part of the actual YAML file, and they're not going to do that. The reason why it makes sense, I shouldn't be allowed to make a code change.
Because if you change it, you could take their approvals. Yeah,
exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah, if I do a push. So they're like, no, you're not going to be able to do that. So I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's really nice. So as I'm building, I'm committing to my dev branches and all that sort of feature branches and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that whenever I do a commit with a new feature or what have you, it's always going to go and get pushed to that later, to that dev environment. And I can go check it out in Office 365 actually running right after my commit and after the build's finished and the deploy is finished. And then when I'm finished with my feature, I'd merge that into the staging branch, right? I'd push it off, you know, push it into staging, go through all those checks and balances. And that would also go to the staging environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually staging gets merged into prod or the feature also gets merged into prod master branch.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up going out to prod with a manual approval.
Yep, it's exactly what it does.
Super nice.
Isn't that
That's
cool?
That's really good.
It's really slick. There's a whole lot more stuff that we can go into about it too, like talking about build agents and how all that stuff would like. It was the only thing, during my session, somebody asked me about what pricing looks like, and it's the only time I've ever done, well, let me say that differently. from when I started presenting, once I got wise and realized that I should never talk about licensing, it's the first time I've talked about licensing in probably over a decade, because it was like, this is really easy to understand.
Yeah, right?
Okay. So it was like, I went through the whole licensing thing. So just real quick for people who are interested in this, Microsoft maintains a bunch of agent hosted agents. The way you pay for stuff is with an agent. And an agent is the thing that's going to go run your build. So it's a VM or container.
It's where your build runs. Your code actually compiles on that thing. It's a virtual machine or a container or something.
Right. Yep. It's one of those two things, container or virtual machine. And Microsoft maintains hosted agents. So they have a Windows hosted agent, a Linux, and a Mac OS hosted agent. You can use those. Now, out of the box with your Azure DevOps account, you get one hosted agent for your organization.
This is the free version of Azure DevOps.
Yeah. You get one hosted agent for a private repo, for all of your private repos. It's shared across all of them. And 1,800 minutes a month, right? Mm. Which comes out to, I think, like 30 hours, right? So you get 30 hours of build time a month. If you need to add more of those, so if you've gone over your 1,800, you can buy another hosted agent for, I think, $40 a month, and it's prorated, right? So you can get another 1,800 minutes.
It also gives you the ability to do parallel builds as well, right?
If you have two, yes, you can do parallel builds. And parallel builds let you do like two jobs can run at once. So in our example, we could have had build and test run side by side. And then when those were finished, then two of the three deployments could run side by side as well.
Gotcha.
Right? And that's not just per pipeline. That's across your entire org.
So yeah, it could be shared.
Yeah, it could be shared. Now, the other option is if you want more control over it. And so there's a self-hosted way of doing it. And that's where there's no time, like there's no time box on the minutes. And with that, you have to spin up your own virtual machine, your own container. You install an agent on that guy that knows, and then you go configure it so it knows how to talk to Azure DevOps, and Azure DevOps can talk to it.
Mm.
And for that, it's whatever it costs to run your agent. So you can do it on-prem and just use your own infrastructure. You can use an Azure VM and pay for that with your Azure credits. I'm going to come back to yours in just a minute because you showed me something right before the show that I want you to mention. And then the other option that you have is, those are the two options. So the way that that works is that with the self-hosted option, you get one of those in your account for free. And then if you're an MSDN or Visual Studio Enterprise subscriber, you get another one of those for free.
And when it's just the ability to hook in a self-hosted build agent.
You still have to pay for the actual resource that you're using.
Yep.
But for Azure DevOps to use that and treat it as an agent, those two things are free.
But it's not $40 a month.
It's, it's 15. If you want to add your own self-hosted, it's $15 a month.
Yep.
So you could add a bunch more agents and be like, yep, this is how I want to do it, another $15 a month.
That effectively gives you it gives you a pool of agents, mm-hmm. and you can tag them so they've got different capabilities, right? So, so you can have some that are Windows boxes mm-hmm. if you need to do builds that require Windows to build. You can do Linux build agents, and they can have prerequisites attached to them. So you might have things pre-installed on those build agents that you need for your build.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can say in a particular project in Azure DevOps, you can say, build this on an agent from this particular pool that satisfies these requirements.
Right. So for our Hugo stuff, in our Hugo builds and our deploys, we have to install the Hugo installer on the agent every time the build runs because it's not there. But had we used our own agents that we were connected to, we could have created a container, created a VM, installed Hugo on there, and then just taken that step out and say, you just assume that it's already there.
Yeah.
Same way you can assume that like Node is already there. Or in the case of the SharePoint framework, maybe you want to install SPFX. Not SPFX, Office 365 CLI.
Yeah, and it just saves you a bit of time and download and stuff. One of the reasons I created a self-host build agent, it was a Windows version, was that actually ran on-prem, was because we wanted to code sign our builds using a certificate.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't comfortable putting our company's certificate on a build agent that I didn't control, right? And so we set up a self-hosted build. We had a code signing cert pre-installed on that machine. And so the build would happen, we're all hooked up into Azure DevOps. The build would happen on-prem on that box, and then it would sign the code at the end before it went and did the deploy. And so our cert never left our control, so to speak.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. That's it in a nutshell, but that's it in what, like 30 minutes that we just did, 23 minutes?
So what was the thing you were mentioning that you wanted me to get into about self-hosted agents?
Where do you do your self-hosted agent? Because I was playing with like, oh, I'm going to go through and do an Azure VM. And like, I don't know how I'm going to set this up and everything.
Yeah, so a cunning thing that one of my coworkers actually brought up was there's another host There's another cloud hosting company that's called Vultr, VULTR.com, I believe is the URL. And they give you really, really cheap virtual machines in the cloud. And so for a few dollars, like we're talking about $5 a month.
Yeah.
Like really cheap.
Well, I mean, the one that you were showing, do you mind if I say what I saw?
No, of course, go for it.
So you had a build agent, you had a VM host that was hosting, I think, three of your agents?
Three Azure DevOps agents. So we get three parallel build, like,
yeah,
parallel builds to the times three, right?
Yeah, and this is supporting your product for all of your Kubernetes, all your containers and everything.
That's where all that stuff's building.
And it was on a six virtual CPU, 16 gigs of RAM.
Virtual machine?
Yeah, virtual machine. And you'd only, we're in the latter part of the month.
$65.
$62, I think it was $65, yeah.
Yep.
Was how much you had spent. I mean, that's...
And that's a pretty beefy machine for builds, right? 16 gig of RAM and six cores. And we started off on a much smaller machine, but when we ramped up to multiple parallel builds, we actually have quite a lot of stuff going on during our builds, and we wanted to get them out really fast because our devs, when they commit a build, we want it to be in a dev environment as fast as possible.
Yeah.
So to keep things very responsive and really fast, we decided to self-host versus the hosted in the cloud. One of the things we found with the hosted in the cloud builds is they can sometimes take a little while to kick off, right? So sometimes it would be a matter of seconds before the build started, but other times it was a matter of a couple of minutes before a build started, and that was unacceptable to us.
Gotcha.
We wanted the commit to happen, the build to start, the deploy to happen, and it to be done as fast as possible. So, so that's what we landed on, Vultr.
That's cool. I'm gonna spinning up one of those hopefully before my session and trying to set up a few of my agents there, because I was looking at like six virtual CPU and 16 gigs of RAM. I was looking at a Linux VM, a D2 that had, I think, two CPUs and 4 gigs of RAM was gonna cost me $30 to $40 a month. So that's like the box you have is three times in terms of the processing power, 4 times in the memory capacity, and it's only another $20 a month from what you guys had. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to try this.
And it's not like anything stays there. None of the assets stay there.
No.
We don't have anything important that sticks around after the build. It's literally just a box to do the build.
Gotcha. Yep. Very cool. So that's Azure DevOps. Why don't we switch over and go to the last part of our segment where we screwed up last week. We'll explain that in a minute. But first, let's hear from another one of our great sponsors.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right, last week we kind of messed up. Last week we were on a time box. We had these picks in there and we actually left them in the show notes and they made it out in the show notes last week, which by the time you hear this, they will be out of the show notes.
They may not be a surprise, but we'll still talk about them.
Exactly. Well, they're definitely not a surprise to one of our great listeners, Julie Turner, because she let us know that, hey, you guys forgot your picks. I'm like, no, we didn't. We intentionally pulled them out because we ran out of time. She goes, no, they're in the show notes. I'm like, oh, crap.
Oops.
That was our fault. So CJ, why don't you start us off with a pick?
Yeah, so you know how there's people in the world that think the Earth is still flat?
It's not.
Newsflash, buddy.
Oops.
Yeah, it's not. Satellites orbit the Earth.
Gotcha. Okay.
The orbit is a circular thing, and it's not circling. It's not circling the disk.
It's circling a piece of paper. Okay.
So anyway, there's a new book by this chap who's putting out self-published. He's doing a fundraising campaign put out this beautiful book, 300-page book of photographs of stuff to do with space.
Mm.
So artifacts from the space programs, everything from like a rubber stamp that Neil Armstrong used to stamp off on approvals for certain things, stuff like that. Anyway, he's putting out this book and he started putting ads out on Facebook for it. And his ads kept being pulled down by Facebook because they were deemed as inappropriate. And it was all the flat earthers complaining to Facebook about this guy's ad. Anyway, so cutting a long story short, he figured this out after he dealt with an ad specialist who knew somebody at Facebook who could they could talk about this with, and his ads got approved, and they've stuck with it and all that. The photographs are amazing. I know you're flipping through a few now.
I'm a little distracted.
Some really cool stuff. But long story short, his ads are now running and everything's cool. But I thought, what better way to stick it to the flat earthers than back this project?
I like this idea.
I have backed this Kickstarter, and it's called NASA Past and Present Dreams of the Future. Can go to it. It's this amazing book, 300 pages of beautiful photography of all these amazing space artifacts, and it's going to look great on my coffee table.
Right next to our Apollo 11 mission plan.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's my pick.
That's awesome. My pick is a guy who went to, I'm a big IndyCar fan, and a guy went to I think it was Road America, a recent IndyCar race, and he filmed it, and he had this really cool little project. He took a 1968 camera, filmed it with the camera, so it looks like it was filmed back in 1968, like with the quality of the film and how it's kind of like grainy a little bit, and it's got a little faded look to it.
Yep. It's not super high frame rate.
It's not super high HD
anything.
Nope. And he did a really good job, too, of getting the same like perspective of the race as you would if you were filming it from the 60s. Not only that, he went and took the video and he produced it with a bunch of voiceover and clips, and it sounds like somebody was broadcasting the race from the 60s. It is so cool. So you're watching these like modern cars and everything, but it looks, you see like the cars are all real and you have like the same kind of like grainy kind of, it's a little shaky.
Great and, coloring and everything. Yeah.
It's a little shaky, but you see brand new Ferraris in the foreground. And
it looks so much cooler.
It really does.
It's kind of retro and awesome.
Yeah.
Nice work.
We also had an awesome listener pick submitted.
Yes, this is an absolute keeper.
This is epic. Rob Windsor submitted this pick, and it's a story from Wired. And I'm not going to spoil too much of this, but let's just say I would strongly recommend that no one makes their license plate the word null. He has had so many problems with this. He got a ticket and just...
It's genius. Yeah, so in a nutshell, this guy thought, I'm going to be a smart ass. Yeah. And he got a personalized plate that just said null on it, thinking, I'm going to mess with databases. I'm never going to get a ticket. This is going to be fantastic. Turned out to be quite the opposite. He's caused all sorts of problems for him.
He did a great job messing with it, but it's come back to bite him.
Exactly. It's a really interesting story. Actually, along similar lines, there was another guy who printed out a really long paper number plate that was basically a SQL injection attack, right? So he started off with, you know, like a close quote, right? And then he had drop table, blah, 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 yada, 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 and he stuck it on his license plate, and then he kept driving past traffic cameras trying to drop the DMV's ticket database. It was pretty entertaining. So this is, I guess this guy might have drawn inspiration from the SQL injection attack guy.
I suspect he might have,
Yeah, so his name, security researcher trying to mess with databases and having it all backfire on him. Definitely go and read the story. It's really funny.
Definitely a word to the wise. Don't do this.
Exactly.
Sure doesn't look like it's worth the time. It's a cool story, but it's not the way you want to get in Wired.
No.
Cool. Wait, CJ, that was fun.
We'll see you at Ignite.
We'll
next
see
in person, probably.
That's probably when we'll get together again to do this again, but yeah. Tune in for the live show, and for all of our listeners, see you again next week.
Cheers.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a wave or an MP3, and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show, or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.